From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Will Smith, the star of the new movie Ali, which follows Muhammad Ali's life from 1964 to 74. Smith says he's got a lot in common with Ali, starting with syncopation. He began his career as a teenager making rap records under the name The Fresh Prince, who went on to star in his own TV show, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and in the films 6 Degrees of Separation, Independence Day, Men in Black, and Enemy of the State. Also, we remember rhythm and blues singer Rufus Thomas. He died Saturday at the age of 84. He's best known for the novelty song Walkin' the Dog, which was covered by the Rolling Stones. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Afghan and U.S. forces are combing the rugged Tora Bora Mountains bordering Pakistan in the hunt for Osama bin Laden. Pentagon says they don't know whether the accused mastermind of the September 11th terrorist attacks is dead, holed up in a cave, or fled to another country. As NPR's Ivan Watson reports from Tora Bora, according to the commanders of Afghan troops, the last of the al-Qaeda troops have been defeated in Tora Bora.
The Afghan commanders have announced today that al-Qaeda is no longer in a position to resist, that they have been pushed out of Tora Bora, and that the Afghan guerrillas are pursuing them into the mountains around there, and that their duty is to capture them. Now, we can never take the Afghan commander's statements to be 100% true, because they've had such a track record of contradicting themselves and contradicting each other. One commander, in fact, boasted that his men had cleared out the entire area of the mountains all the way until the Pakistani border. Now, that area is rugged. It's steep mountains. It's cold there, and there is snow in the mountains. I've been told by veteran Mujahideen fighters that trying to walk through there, a man could die. The conditions were so difficult.
NPR's Ivan Watson. Secretary of State Colin Powell said today Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat can expect a positive Israeli response once he cracks down on anti-Israeli violence. At a news conference, Powell said once Arafat's call for an end to attacks on Israelis is heeded, the Palestinian leader can expect to see some concessions on the Israeli side. In a speech to his people yesterday, Arafat insisted on a halt to all terrorist activities by Palestinian militants. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta is holding classes for health officials on how to recognize smallpox. Georgia Public Radio's Susanna Capilouto reports.
Smallpox was eradicated in 1980, but the government isn't taking any chances. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has put together a smallpox response plan in case smallpox is used as a bioterrorist weapon. The CDC has started training state and local health officials on how to recognize smallpox. The agency wants to make sure it is not confused in its early stages with less dangerous infections like chickenpox or even syphilis. CDC classes in Atlanta will last for 3 days. Health officials say there's no real evidence that intentionally released smallpox is any more of a threat than it was before September 11th. One CDC official said that it's sad these classes have become necessary. For NPR News, I'm Susanna Capilouto in Atlanta.
On Wall Street today, stock prices were generally higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 81 points to finish at 9,891, volume of 1.2 billion shares. The Nasdaq rose 34 points and the S&P 500 closed up 11. You're listening to NPR News. The White House says President Bush underwent a medical procedure on Friday to have 4 lesions removed from his face. None of the lesions were cancerous. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president had 2 lesions on his cheeks, one on his forehead and another on his temple. They were removed in the White House physician's office by freezing them with liquid nitrogen, a common procedure. 2 of the lesions were of a type that can lead to cancer if untreated. None of this was released by the administration until the president showed up at a White House ceremony Monday afternoon with a group of Muslim children. Dark spots were visible on his face. When his press secretary, Ari Fleischer, was asked about it afterward, he released a statement explaining the procedure. Fleischer said that the president routinely receives periodic evaluations and uses sunscreen, as is recommended for all individuals with a history of significant exposure to the sun. Doctors say that such lesions are common among Americans who've spent a lot of time outdoors. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide addressed his nation today following an attack on the National Palace. In a speech broadcast on radio, he said the coup was thwarted, but it's not over. Commandos stormed the palace earlier today, killing four people before police recaptured the building. In all, at least seven people died in today's violence. The Justice Department today recommended against a proposed alliance between Fort Worth-based American Airlines and British Airways. The government says the deal would threaten competition and could lead to higher prices and less service. Justice Department blocked a similar alliance marketing request in 1996. Despite today's ruling by the Justice Department, the two airlines say they're confident the Department of Transportation will decide in favor of the deal. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novasoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Will Smith plays the great boxer Muhammad Ali in the new movie Ali. It was directed by Michael Mann, who directed The Insider. The movie begins in 1964, the year Ali won the World Boxing Association championship by defeating Sonny Liston, and soon after announced that he had converted to Islam and was changing his name from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali. Will Smith had to work on his boxing moves to play Ali, but he already knew how to rhyme. He was still a teenager when, under the name The Fresh Prince, he teamed up with DJ Jazzy Jeff and started having rap hits like Parents Just Don't Understand. He started his acting career as the star of the sitcom The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. His subsequent movies include 6 Degrees of Separation, Men in Black, Independence Day, and Enemy of the State. Let's start with a scene from Ali. Cassius Clay is weighing in, preparing to fight Sonny Liston, taunting Liston with his rhymes.
Sonny Liston, you ain't no champ. You're a chump. Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Ah! Rumble, young man, rumble. Y'all want to lose y'all money? Then you bet it on Sonny. He know I'm great. He will fall in eight. Come on, you big ugly bear. I'll whoop you right now.
Two ten and a half. The challenger. Cassius Clay, 210 and a half pounds.
Man, you showed us right. Oh, ugly bear, come on, let's go. You got all these folks fooled. I ain't scared of you.
218. Sonny Liston, the champion of the world. 218 pounds.
Pounds of what?
Pounds of ugly. That man's so ugly, when he sweat, the sweat run backwards off his forehead just to stay away from his face. Come on, you big ugly bear, I'll turn you into a rug.
Will Smith, welcome to Fresh Air. So what did you have to do different to get Ali's voice when Ali was doing his rhymes or just, you know, doing his bragging thing?
Well, essentially, his voice, he has a really big, wide open chest, which gives you that really heavy resonance, but he constricts his throat, which gives you a really sort of higher pitch, nasally sound. So I had dialect instructors that were teaching me how to technically, where to place my tongue and how to hold my teeth and all of that in order to create the sound that Muhammad Ali created with his voice. So I mean, after a while it became natural, but in the beginning it was really, you know, constricted and really affected, and, you know, trying to stand up straight and trying to keep my chin down and all of those special little tricks that they taught me to create the sound.
Can you demonstrate what you did with your voice?
Can I demonstrate? Well, then I'd have to charge you my full fee.
Right. Well, fair enough. Do you feel like you learned more about how to brag by playing Ali?
Well, I was pretty good before I started the movie.
Right.
You know, the thing that I think Ali and I have in common, as far as being able to say things that might be seemingly perceived as arrogant or cocky or offensive, is the sense of humor. When you add humor to the comments, sometimes it makes it easier for people to handle and easier for people to digest. And there's certain things that other people just simply couldn't say that I can get away with or Ali can get away with because of the level of comedy that's involved.
And part of what Ali deals with is how Muhammad Ali became political, why he refused to fight in Vietnam, how he became a Muslim. Let's hear another scene from the film. And in this film, he's telling the press why he refuses to fight in Vietnam.
Are you going to dodge the draft? I ain't draft dodging, I ain't burning no flag, and I ain't running to Canada. I'm staying right here. You want to send me to jail? Fine, you go right ahead. I've been in jail for 400 years. I could be there for four or five more. But I ain't going no 10,000 miles to help murder and kill other poor people. If I want to die, I'll die right here, right now, fighting you. If I want to die, you my enemy. Not no Chinese, no Viet Cong, no Japanese. You my poser when I want freedom. You my poser when I want justice. You my poser when I want equality. Want me to go somewhere and fight for you? You won't even stand up for me right here in America, for my rights and my religious beliefs. You won't even stand up for me right here at home.
Will Smith, of the things that you learned about Ali and his politics and his conversion to Islam, and of the things you learned about the politics of the period, what had the greatest influence on you? Did any of that change your mind on anything or get you thinking about things you hadn't thought about before?
Well, up until that point, I'm a child of essentially the 80s and 90s, so the 60s are really foreign. And Michael Mann brought in a gentleman named Geronimo Gigiga, formerly Geronimo Pratt of the Black Panthers. And he explained the young black radical point of view to me in a way that I never had understood. He said, war had been declared on Black America. He said, yeah, fire hoses, dogs, domestic terrorism, the bombings of the church. He says, that's war. We were at war in America. And that concept really made a lot of sense. And it became clear how the times really dictated and demanded a Muhammad Ali. Of course, Muhammad Ali is not going to go fight in Vietnam because he's fighting a war in America. I'm not going to go to Vietnam and fight some people that I don't even know when my women and children are being attacked and beaten and killed here. I'm at war here. I can't fight two wars at one time. So let's finish this one up, and then we'll talk about that other one. And that concept of war being declared on Black America was the concept that really gave me a more accurate picture of the 60s and helped me to understand Muhammad Ali's necessity for the connection with the Nation of Islam and the necessity for the strength of his spiritual convictions.
Were there questions about Ali that you were able to ask Ali and get answers about?
He and his family were completely a part of the entire process. So all along the way, Ali was completely available.
So what kind of things did you want to ask him about himself or his motivations that you were able to get interesting answers about?
I guess that the thing that became really clear just in talking to him was his relationship with his wives. And the big thing that came out of those discussions was that he never lied. He would never tell his wives one thing and do something else. And that really helped me to color a lot of the scenes that he had with the different wives and the women in the film. There's a certain non-predatory attachment that Muhammad Ali has with women. And in the film, even when you're seeing him, he's married and you're seeing him making passes at another woman, it's so different than it normally feels, so different than the normal dog approach that you're seeing. There's an attachment to femininity that he has that became clear in conversations with him.
Were Muhammad Ali's politics debated by your parents when you were young? Did you ever hear them talk about him?
Well, my father was in the Air Force, so there was a brief period where he was very uncomfortable with Muhammad Ali's points of view. But I wasn't even born until 68, so things were beginning to calm down by the time I was old enough to start having an opinion and a point of view. So most of what I know and most of what I've gotten from my parents about the period is in research and in retrospect.
My guest is Will Smith. He stars in the new movie Ali. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Will Smith. He's starring as Muhammad Ali in the new movie, Ali. You had a record a few years ago, I Think I Can Beat Mike Tyson, where you tell Don King to set up a match at the Trump, and mm-hmm. you have this whole fantasy thing. Yeah. So let's hear an excerpt of that record.
Hey, Leroy.
Yeah?
Did you hear about that boy, Mike Tyson?
Mike Tyson, he the boy that played football for Montreal, ain't he?
No, you old coop, he a boxer, man. Yeah. Let me tell you, I went to his fight a couple months ago. I seen him hit that boy, and he hit that boy so hard, his head flew off into the 18th row. Yeah. He had to go get his head out the 18th row. I was in Jeff's crib one night about 8, and we were watching a couple of Mike Tyson fight tapes. Jeff was like,
man, you see how hard Mike's punching?
Come on, Jeff, the other guy was just lunging. Left, right, another KO. Ooh. If that was me, I'd have been okay, though. The very next day, I gave Russell a ring with JL and Lior, and we all called Don King. I said, yeah, Don, I got a problem.
Tell him, Prince.
Yeah, what's up? What you saying? You trying to solve them? Forget the small talk. Let's get to the nitty-gritty. Me and Mike, 2 months. Trump, Atlantic City.
Yo, you got this. You gonna bust dude up.
Yeah, you can be my trainer.
Word up?
I'm rough like a freight train, smooth like ice. And yo, Jeff, straight up, I think I can beat Mike Tyson.
Man, you could beat him, man.
Yo, man, word.
You could beat him, man.
You know, I put on a couple pounds, man. We can do this,
you can
man.
Do it.
So Will Smith, in your fantasy of fighting Mike Tyson, you take such a beating in the first round. You punch your coach so you can run away from the ring. Were you much of a fighter?
Not really. I never was a good fighter. But I guess at about 12 or 13 years old, I was in school and I got into a fight in school with a guy named Jason Murphy, and he punched me square in the middle of my nose with all he had. And I realized that it only took a second for me to clear up. And while I was standing there realizing that it didn't really hurt that bad, he punched me again. And I was, it was a strange moment, but it was when I discovered that I could take a punch. And the second that I realized I was like comfortable getting hit, I became a better fighter tenfold. And I think that really helped me in this project, that not being scared to get hit is the center of what makes a fighter be able to be in a rugged war in the ring, because you already know that you're going to get hit. So your approach to that, you got to be in a position to get hit in order to hit somebody. And, fortunately, Ali didn't get hit a lot, but that mindset of not running and not being scared is hugely important to be successful in the ring.
Now, how come you made the record, I Think I Can Beat Mike Tyson, which, you know, so much of rap is about bragging how strong you are and how tough mm-hmm. you are. And this is about running out of the ring mm-hmm. in fear. What inspired that?
You know, I always knew that you know, contrast is comedy. So because rap music so went the other direction, that's, to me, that's what would make the concept funny, and that's what would make people enjoy the record, the fact that it was so different.
Do you ever worry that people think, oh, well, Will Smith, he's just a wimp?
Well, you know, I'm 6'2", 200 and probably about 5 pounds right now, so that would be a crucial mistake for a person right now.
True, but you're kind of pumped up because of the movie. I don't know if you.
Oh yeah, and plus
you weighed that much before. Yeah,
I've been training for a year and a half. I was up to 223 pounds for the film, but I actually you enjoy being in that position a little better because it gives you the element of surprise.
Enjoying, oh, that people think that you're not that
yeah,
tough.
Absolutely.
And then
gives you the element of surprise. Right. Then when their friends are helping them back to the car, they're trying to figure out what happened.
Well, has that actually, have you needed that? Have people ever tried to challenge you because you're famous and because you're self-deprecating in some of your rhymes? They figure, well, yeah. I can take him.
Well, a whole lot now that I played Ali.
Right.
So that, yeah, you know, now that's what Sylvester Stallone told me that too. You know, when I talked to him and I told him I was doing Ali, he said, oh man, he said, every movie theater and bar and mall in the country, everybody's going to want to fight you now.
Isn't that annoying? I mean, don't you feel like saying to the world, it's a movie?
Well, no, the thing is, if you drop one person real good and try to get hard copy or something to get it on tape, it'll be cool.
Right, right. Might as well make it pay. So what was training camp like for you?
Grueling, to say the least. We had a guy named Daryl Foster who trained me, and from day one he said there ain't no actors in this training camp. This is a fighter's training camp, and we trained for about a year before shooting. We trained 3 times a day, so it was a very grueling training camp with all professional fighters. So I got a crash course, literally.
Right.
The gloves crashing into my head.
So did you have to actually take punches for the shoot?
Yeah, we decided very early on that there would be no movie fighting in this film, that all of the fighting was going to be real punches, real fighting. We would essentially do it like a stunt. You know, you set it up, you get 5 or 6 cameras going, and when we got in the ring, you know, we looked at each other, gave each other a pound, and went at it. And I think when people see the film, they'll be really shocked and amazed at how authentic the boxing is, because there's no fake punches. Every time it looks like somebody got hit, it looks that way because somebody got hit.
But they didn't get hit as hard as they would if it was a real match.
Oh, no. Everybody's getting cracked.
Right.
No, when you say, well, I mean, there's a talking about it is one thing. When people see the film, they will understand. There's you can't fake sweat flying off of somebody's head, you know, and there's none of that slow motion and all that. It is good, clean shots.
Now, when Ali got punched, he didn't know that this was going to happen a few minutes before mm-hmm. it did. Whereas, you know, in this scene, you get hit hard. So does that help or
no,
not to know that it's coming?
Yeah, that's worse. That is much worse. That's what I told Ali. You know, I told him making this movie was way tougher than any of those fights that he had in real life. I said, you didn't know Joe Frazier was about to knock you down, but I knew James Toney was about to clip me good.
So what do you do to prepare for that?
You bite down on your mouthpiece really hard. Could be you don't want to have your mouth hanging open when you get hit, and you know you'd be surprised how and it's a really weird feeling. I know it sounds bizarre, but there's something that's really cathartic about getting hit and standing up. You know, somebody knocks you down and you get yourself back together and you stand up again. There's something really there's an animalistic quality that creates something inside of you when you stand up again.
What was the worst punch you took?
It was the James Toney left hook, the one where Ali gets knocked down by Joe Frazier. Because essentially, we had all agreed earlier that again, there's no movie fighting. So I went to James Toney before we did it, and I said, "Listen, this is for our families. This is for our children. This is for Ali's legacy." I said, "So don't play with it. Go ahead, throw the punch in there. Let's get it good, and let's go home." And he said, "All right, man, I'll let it happen." I said, "Oh, and by the way," and then I just punched him in the nose right before the take. And he was like, "Okay." But that may not have been the best idea. It got the, because he laid into it pretty nicely on me.
But if you're getting hit really hard, wouldn't you be all bruised before the final take?
Well, we were shooting it like a stunt almost. So we would have a lot of cameras rolling to make sure that we got it. And generally, the big shots were later in the day.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, no, it does. I mean, it sounds like a really strange way to make a film, but when you see it, you'll understand, because there's an authenticity that's created, and not even the big punches. And you people that are listening are probably thinking Rocky, where you're getting hit 10 times in a round. I mean, in that fight, I only got hit one time, so it's there's other shots that are grazing off the head, and other shots that are body shots, and shots that slip off of the chin, but there was only one big dead on the button shot. And if you watch real fights, guys aren't getting hit every single round. Guys can go 3 and 4 rounds without taking a big, huge dead on the button shot. And that's how our fights were done also.
Will Smith stars in the new movie Ali. It opens Christmas Day. Smith will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Miami. South Beach, bringing the heat. Can y'all feel that? Can y'all feel that? Jig it out. Here I am in the place where I come let go. In Miami, the base and the sunset low. Every day like a Mardi Gras. Everybody party all day. No work, all play, okay? So we sip a little something, leave the rest to spill. Me and Charlie at the bar running up a high bill. Nothing less than ill when we dress to kill. Every time the ladies pass, they be like, can y'all feel me? All ages and races, real sweet faces. Every different nation, Spanish, Haitian, Indian, Jamaican, black, white, Cuban, or Asian. I only came for 2 days of playing, but every time I come, I always wind up staying. This the type of town I can spend a few days in. Miami, the city that keeps the roof blazing.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the National Endowment for the Arts, and sponsored in part by Nonsuch Records, featuring composer John Adams' El Nino, an oratorio on the Nativity story featuring Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, Dawn Upshaw, and Willard White, conducted by Kent Nagano. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember rhythm and blues singer Rufus Thomas, best known for Walkin' the Dog and other novelty dance records. He died Saturday at the age of 84. Also, Will Smith talks about his early rap records. He's starring in the new film Ali.
Well, my dog can monkey just like you, but can you monkey to the dude?
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actor and rap music star Will Smith. He plays Muhammad Ali in the new film Ali. Did you have to audition for the part, or did they just know they wanted you?
It was pretty much, I had the script for 5 or 6 years, and I had turned the script down over and over and over.
Why would you turn it down?
I couldn't see the road from Will Smith to Muhammad Ali. I was not going to be the dude that people were laughing at and you know, every time they see Ali feeling bad that I messed up his legacy. I wasn't going to be that dude.
What changed your mind?
When I finally met with Michael Mann, it was the first time that I could see the road where the intellectual path had been laid out. He said, listen, this is the situation. He said, I understand exactly what you're thinking, exactly what you're feeling, but I am going to create the curriculum that will create Muhammad Ali inside of you. This is what we're going to do. It's a three-tiered approach. The first is the physical. We're going to run the way Muhammad Ali ran. We're going to eat the way Muhammad Ali ate. We're going to spar the way he sparred. We're going to train the way he trained. And by we, he meant me. And he laid out all the stuff that we're going to do for the first tier of the physical. The second tier was the mental and emotional. And he said, through understanding the physical strain of a fighter, then you'll understand the mental and emotional strain of a fighter. Through understanding physically what Muhammad Ali had to do, for example, standing in the ring, and you know when the bell rings, there's this animal on the other side who wants nothing more than to tear your head off. By being in that physical position, you'll understand the mental and emotional strain that it must have been to be in that situation, fight after fight after fight. And then through understanding the mental and emotional, that would take us to the third tier, which is his spirituality. And through understanding the physicality and the emotionality, then you would understand the necessity for his spiritual convictions.
Now, the strange thing about going through this routine is that it really should be changing you as a person, because it's not like you're just doing this in front of a camera when you're on the set. You're training like this for a long period of time.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, do you feel like it changed you in ways that you either like or don't like?
Oh, it completely adjusted, and not adjusted as much as confirmed exactly who I am. And by confirming and clarifying who I am, it made it more transparent exactly who I want to be. And then, you know, the experience, we shot for almost 2 months in Africa, and to sit and meet with Nelson Mandela and his wife Gracia Michelle, and to be in Mozambique, and I mean, just the entire experience has completely confirmed on many points and adjusted on others exactly who I want to be.
Which is great.
I'm already great. No, I would say just, you know, to be with Muhammad Ali and with Nelson Mandela, it just, you know, one thing just continually kept popping into my mind, and it's that I suck. It's like I am just so unimportant and useless on this planet, and you know, I don't feel like the abilities that I've been blessed with and the connection with children and the forum that I've been given, I think it would be a spiritual crime to use only for nice clothes and cars and houses.
So you plan on doing what?
Well, I'm going to take my family for, you know, a year. I want to put my children in school in South Africa. Mandela is about 80 years old right now. So I just, you know, I want my children to meet him and know him, and in the same way that I had the opportunity to be with Muhammad Ali, and I want them to spend some time and, you know, do some work over there. I just felt profoundly miseducated and unimportant when I went to Africa. So I don't want my children to be miseducated in the way that I was miseducated about the world.
Are you saying you want to go into politics too?
You know, I'm sure exactly what it is. I'm waiting for my divine inspiration, but I do more and more every day feel less and less effective, and especially in the wake of September 11th. I mean, I feel very happy that I have a film like Ali coming out after September 11th, a film that actually has something that people can take home.
Well, Will Smith is my guest. He's starring in the new movie, Ali. I'm going to go back to your early career.
Mm-hmm.
As we mentioned before, Ali's rhymes were always about how great he was and how he was going to defeat his opponent. And your early raps were very funny, very self-deprecating.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a time in rap. I mean, I guess it's always been that time in rap where raps have been mostly about either bragging about how great your rhymes are, bragging about what a great lover you are, or bragging about how tough you are, or how many women you have, whatever. But your really breakthrough record, Parents Just Don't Understand, was about getting taken to the shopping mall by your mother who wants to buy you all these awful clothes that are going to ruin your credibility.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, why don't we hear a little bit of that?
You know, parents are the same, no matter time, no place. They don't understand that us kids are going to make some mistakes. So to you other kids all across the land, there's no need to argue. Parents just don't understand. My mom took me school shopping. It was me, my brother, my pop, and my little sister all hopped in the car. We headed downtown to the Gallery Mall. My mom started bugging with the clothes she chose. I didn't say nothing at first. I just turned to my nose. She said, "What's wrong? This shirt costs $20. I said, "Mom, the shirt is plaid with a butterfly collar." The next half hour was the same old thing. My mother buying me clothes from 1963. And then she lost her mind and did the ultimate. I asked her for Adidas and she bought me Zips. I said, "Mom, what are you doing? You ruined my rep." She said, "You're only 16. You don't have a rep yet." I said, "Mom, let's put these clothes back, please." She said, "No. You go to school to learn, not for a fashion show." I said, "This is a shot."
That's the Fresh Prince, Will Smith. Will Smith, how did you end up taking that direction in your early rap records and going the self-deprecating route and admitting that you had a mother? I mean, most rap records don't admit they even have a mother.
But, well, you know, really, I was coming out of the early years of rap music, which were less about being tough and more about parties. So, I mean, it was still out. What I was doing was still sort of out of place, but I was younger making rap records than a lot of the people that were my peers in the rap world at that time. So I was basically an old school rapper with a new school crowd. So the style was based on there was a guy when I was coming up named Grandmaster Caz, and Grandmaster Caz used to make his party rhymes, but it was always funny, and his rhymes always had a comedic edge to them. And essentially, I created my entire style after Grandmaster Caz. But I mean, he was as rare as I was. But the style is essentially based on being different. It's based upon doing something that will stand out and be as different as it could possibly be from all the other records that were being created at the time.
Now, did the persona on that record suit your real personality? I mean, was your mother really taking you to the Gallery, the shopping mall in Philadelphia, and buying you the wrong sneakers?
Oh, yeah. My mom you know, she's really good at a lot of things, but the whole combination of clothes with the shoes, yeah, my mom wasn't like the best at that. You're good at it, Mom, now. But oh wow, you're in Philly, right? Yeah, so yeah. My mom's gonna be okay. Yeah, Mom, you weren't great at it, but you were good. But yes, it was tough some days, and it was even worse for my brother, because then after I was done with the stuff, he had to wear it old. At least I got to wear it new.
Well, how would you wear the wrong clothes to school? I mean, when you knew you were wearing clothes that you hated, mm-hmm. that other people. That your friends would hate too.
Yeah, that's
it.
That
would make you look
foolish.
Yeah, what do you do so that you can still not look foolish in spite of what you're wearing?
You just hope that somebody else has worse clothes than you, so you know, so then you can ride them. And I was always pretty funny, so that being funny was a pretty good defense, because even if someone had nicer clothes on me, I could make the crowd think that their clothes were worse than mine just by the jokes.
Like what? What would you say?
Oh, God, anything. I remember when Haggar washable slacks came out. And that's, you know, if you called somebody's pants Haggar washable reversible slacks, you know, and you just, you know, you show them flipping them inside and out. They wear them one way on Monday and flip them inside out on Tuesday. You know, and if, like, you know, you act that out physically, then you can generally make people laugh with that.
My guest is Will Smith. He's starring in the new movie Ali. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor and rap music star Will Smith. He's starring in the new movie Ali. Now you weren't from a poor family. Your mother worked for the school board. Your father owned a refrigeration business. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that being, you know, did it feel like it would be more authentic if you did rap records if you were poor? You know, because sometimes authenticity in rap has been equated with being poor and being from a neighborhood where there's a lot of gang banging.
Well, I mean, the neighborhood that I was from was, you know, working class neighborhood. I mean, it was, we had our share of shootings and drug dealers. So, I mean, essentially, I am from the same type of neighborhood that those people are from. I just had, I took a different approach. You know, there wasn't, you know, it wasn't something that I embraced. You know, I avoided the drug dealers and avoided the dudes shooting craps on the corners and all of that. It just wasn't something that I chose to embrace, but it was definitely something that was a part of my neighborhood.
No, I mean, you know, so many rap records are about standing up to the police, and you know, some of yours are about standing up to your parents.
Mm-hmm, right. Yeah,
funny.
You know, I mean, the thing is, it's like that. That's just not the aspect of my life that I was trying to embrace. I mean, as far as the run-ins with the police, I mean, I was 17 years old with a red IROC, so I had plenty of run-ins,
right.
with the police, had filed plenty of reports with internal affairs and reporting police and all that. I mean, the difference is that I always took the intellectual approach to dealing with the police. I know what the laws are. You know, police, you know, back then, the police, they had to have their hats on when they pulled your cars over. So if a cop got out the car and didn't have his hat on, I made sure I knew he didn't have his hat on.
And how would you do that?
I'll say, excuse me, sir, I do believe that your protocol dictates that you have to have your hat on in order to pull me over, so you can go get that.
And would they?
More times than not, they would. They would call you a really bad name, and then they would realize that you knew something if you knew that. So their approach was a little less. It would be more verbally offensive, but a lot less potentially physically offensive.
Will Smith is my guest, and he's starring in the new movie about Muhammad Ali called Ali. You're really good with rhymes, and your recordings tend to tell interesting stories. I mean, they could almost mm-hmm. be a sketch. Mm-hmm. Did you ever write stories?
Yeah, when I was probably 12 years old, 13 years old, I used to write stories about my friends, and I would make them superheroes, and I would sell them. I would sell them their story, you know, Super Terry. You know,
what powers you want to give me?
Yeah, you know, that's what we would talk about, and we'd figure out what powers that you wanted to have and stuff like that. And then I would write a story where the kids were superheroes, and you know, sell them for, you know, 50 cents or a dollar or something like that. But I was doing that probably 12 years old to about 14 years old. I was doing that. My mother worked for the school board, and my grandmother was very much into education. So we were always writing and creating stories or reading Bible verses. We were always doing something literary.
Did you always have satisfied customers, or did your friends ever say, I didn't like the story, I want my 50 cents back?
Well, I would never, we didn't do refunds, but we would we would rewrite the story, you know, if you wanted a story adjustment. You know, I wasn't above a rewrite.
I guess that's good experience.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, you can't get a cheese back.
So with your mother working for the school board, did she correct you a lot if you used improper grammar?
Oh, yeah, we were.
Or slang
we were,
in your speech?
Yeah, we weren't allowed to use improper speech. You know, you would run out of the house. And say, yo, what's up? What y'all about to do? And mother say, up, back in here. We would get on punishment for words like y'all. And, you know, you'd be in the house in the middle of the summer crying, and my grandmother would come up and say, baby, you know a y'all is a boat.
did that irritate you, or did you think, oh, I'm so glad that she's teaching me proper speech?
You know, yeah, it was, you know, that was, yeah, 12 years old. Oh, yeah, you know what? You're right, Grandma.
You're right.
Proper speech. That's, no, it was it was tough, but that's something I've adapted in my life. I can't stop doing that to other people and to my kids. Very early, I remember that. I mean, it was just always important in my household to say things properly. I mean, in my neighborhood, kids would say "looked it," and my grandmother hated that. You know, kids. Oh, he looked it crazy. Oh man, my grandmother hated that, and that was one that you'd almost get a 30-day punishment for that one. If you said something looked it like something, woo.
Do you feel bilingual?
You mean bilingual in the sense of King's English and Ebonics?
Yeah.
Or English and Spanish?
No.
You know, there's a certain bilingual element that all successful blacks have to have. You know, you have to be able to you know, speak to the head of IBM in a way that gives confidence and communicates a sense of your commitment to excellence and perfection. And it all starts with language. But at the same time, you got to be able to relax and chill with your friends.
Well, good luck with Ali.
Well, thank you very much.
And thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, no, thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Will Smith stars in the new movie Ali. It opens Christmas Day. Coming up, we remember rhythm and blues star Rufus Thomas. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back.
Can I ask y'all something? I said, can I ask y'all something? Yeah. Ain't I'm clean? Yeah. I'm glad to be here today. In fact, I'm glad to be anywhere any day.
Rhythm and blues singer Rufus Thomas was celebrating his 80th birthday in 1997 when he performed at the Chicago Blues Festival. He died Saturday in his hometown of Memphis at the age of 84. Rufus Thomas was famous for his blues and novelty records. In the 50s, 60s, and 70s, he gave us dance records like Do the Funky Chicken, Do the Funky Penguin, The Dog, Can Your Monkey Do the Dog, Somebody Stole My Dog, and the most famous, Walkin' the Dog, which the Rolling Stones also recorded. Thomas gave the Memphis-based label Sun Records its very first hit, Bearcat, the answer song to Big Mama Thornton's recording of Hound Dog. Then in 1960, he gave Stax Records in Memphis its first hit, Cause I Love You, a duet with his daughter, Carla Thomas. Rufus Thomas was in show business since the mid-30s. He often called himself the world's oldest teenager. Rufus Thomas was one of the performers we presented when we did our show at the 1997 Chicago Blues Festival.
Hello, Chicago! Say hello, Rufus! Hello, Chicago! Oh, I love you too.
Now, Rufus isn't going to be performing Walking the Dog because his horn section isn't here. However, we happen to have...
You happen to have what?
We happen to have your CD. Hit it.
You happen to have my CD?
Feel free to demonstrate the dance here.
Oh.
Baby Mac, dressed in black. Silver buttons all down her back. How long, tips and toes. She broke a needle and she can't sew. Walking a dog. That's a walking bird dog.
If you want to tell me, come on.
If you don't know how to do it, I'll show you how to walk a bird dog.
How does the dance go? Now, Rufus Thomas was dancing back in the 1930s in show business with the Rabbit Pit Minstrels.
I was dancing back in the 1930s.
What was your act like in the 1930s?
What was my act like in the 30s? Well, really, in the 30s, I wasn't singing at all. I was a tap dancer. Boy, don't even go there. Don't even think about it. No. See what you started.
That's right.
No, I was a tap dancer at the time, and tap dancing, you know, as things, you know, time goes by, it sort of phased itself out, in which I wasn't doing any tap dancing, and I'm still gonna stay in stay business and show business. I got to find something else to do. So I learned. And I taught myself to sing. But I ain't doing no tap dancing. Don't even think about it.
Now, another part of Rufus Thomas's career, he started doing a show on WDIA back when it became the first station in America to have an all-black music format. And he's still doing the show, and I understand it's the number one show.
That's
the number
right.
one radio show in Memphis.
WDIA in Memphis, Tennessee.
Now, you've really rhymed a lot in your shows. What are some of your favorite ways of signing on and signing off, back from the old days when you were starting?
No, wait a minute. Ain't no back in the old days. Ain't nothing old up here. Look, when I used to sign on at midnight, I had a midnight show called Hoot and Holler. And this is the way it went on. I'm young, I'm loose, I'm full of juice. I got the goose, so what's the use? We feel engaged and we ain't got a dollar. Rufus is here, so hoo and holla.
Rufus Thomas recorded at the 1997 Chicago Blues Festival. He died Saturday at the age of 84. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Y'all come on in now. Come right on down front. I got something I want to show you. Now y'all heard of the popcorn. Y'all heard of the dog. And you heard about all of them other dances. But now that's a brand new dance that's going around. I want to show you exactly what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the funky chicken. Y'all ready? I say y'all ready. Okay, here we go. You raise the left arm up and the right arm too. Let me tell you just what to do. Start boom on the flapping. Start the feet to kicking. That's when you know you're doing the funky chicken. Second spasm. You put both arms up across your face. Your knees start wiggling all over the place. You flap your arms and your feet start kicking. Then you know you're doing the funky chicken. Oh, hey, hey. Oh, I'm feeling it now. I feel so unnecessary. This is the kind of stuff to make you feel like you wanna do something nasty. Like wave some chicken gravy on your white shirt. Right down front. Here we go, y'all. Your white boat arms and your white.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Wreck the Halls, A Holiday Mystery by Sarah Graves, and Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton considers what might have inspired American John Walker to join the Taliban. Lifton has studied cult groups and extremists. Also, we talk about Al-Qaeda with Bernard Lewis, a scholar of the Arab world. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.